So today I want to deal, last 2 weeks we've dealt with decently famous stories. We've dealt with Abraham arguing with God, we dealt with Moses after the golden calf. Both of those, as things go, are pretty famous. This week's story is not, right? This is a very not famous story. It's a very short story, but I think it's actually very profound, and that's what I want to analyze. And that is the story of the blasphemer. So, the story, if you look in number one, we'll read the story and then we'll discuss it, goes as follows. So there came out among the Israelites one whose mother was Israelite and whose father was Egyptian. And a fight broke out in the camp between that half Israelite and a certain Israelite, meaning a full Israelite, a full Jew. During their fight, the son of the Israelite woman pronounced the name, in the name of God, in blasphemy. Now that either means he blasphemed God or he cursed the other person using the name of God. But probably he cursed God. And he was brought to Moses. And the reason he was brought to Moses is because blasphemy, as we will see, is a capital offense. Right? But no, they didn't know that yet. So he's brought to Moses. Now his mother's name was Shlomit, daughter of Divri, of the tribe of Dan. And he was placed in custody until the decision of the Lord should be made clear to them. So he's put in the prison cell, the holding cell, just to figure out what is going on, what do we do with him.
And you said they didn't know that yet, but it was after they didn't. Was it a law that they should have known?
So they, no, meaning they haven't gotten the law yet, right? They don't know what the law is of blasphemy, right?
This is in
Vayikra, right? So in the Aseret HaDibrot we have, don't use God's name in vain, right? But, you know, blasphemy, there was an intuition that it was clearly bad, right? Probably worse than using God's name in vain is using it to curse either a human being or God himself. But what the consequences of that were not clear. Right, what exactly the laws were, they don't know. So what do? You know, they knew he was guilty of something. They put him in a holding cell and they wait for God to weigh in. Yeah?
Isn't it odd that the mother's name is mentioned?
We never see that.
It is very weird. And we will see what the Midrash does with it. And we'll try to understand what it was doing in the Pshat at any rate. But yes, right, these are clues that we have to look for. I mean, what is important about his mother? Why are they telling us? What's going on? Okay.
And his status is only as a half Israelite?
And that is going to be part of the question, right? What's going on, right? What is he, right? He's Jewish, right? Clearly, he's Jewish halachically. But we'll see, right? There's going to be a problem. Even before we see what the Midrash is going to pick up on, right? What weird status would someone whose mother is a Jew but father is not going to have in Israel, right? So religiously he's going to be a Jew, but there's a problem because while Judaism passes through the mother, what passes through the father?
Inheritance,
right? So he's going to be a Jew without inheritance, which is going to be bad, right? Which is what the Midrash will pick up on.
I think there was at one point a patrilineal.
I mean, in Bereshit, right? Judaism seems to pass through primarily through the father, to the extent that, you know, you can talk of a nation of Jews before you have a nation. You're talking about the building of the families, but right here already we see that this is the first indication we have after there's a Jewish nation and not just a Jewish family, let's say. And here we see that it's maternal already, right? Why exactly things seem to change from the family period to the nation period is an interesting question. But at this point, it's clear. The implication is clear. He's Jewish, right? But not going to inherit. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the blasphemer outside the camp, and let all who were within hearing lay their hands upon his head, and let the whole community stone him." Yes, it's very intense. If you look at the picture, right, this is the picture that I put at the top, right? It's a bit graphic. If you can make it out, it's a bit graphic, right?
Yeah.
This is a painting by Gerard Howitt. which I got via Wikimedia Commons. But you can see, right? They're throwing the rocks at him it looks like he's been thrown from that structure first, which would be in accordance with the way the rabbis understand the stoning process to have happened. Right? That first they're thrown from a structure of this sort, and then stoned. So they stone him, and to the Israelite people speak thus: anyone who blasphemes his God shall bear his guilt. If he also pronounces the name Lord, he shall be put to death. The whole community shall stone him, stranger or citizen. If he has thus pronounced the name, he shall be put to death. It's just saying how you will die, right? I mean, there are four capital punishments exactly. That the Torah has. Right? You have stoning, you have burning, you have beheading, and you have strangulation. The death penalty did exist in the Torah. The rabbis assume it happened extremely rarely, and as they say in the Mishnah and Makot, that any court that imposed the death penalty more than once in 70 years was considered overly harsh. It was understood more, less of an actual punishment and more of a way that the Torah would convey how stringent things were, right? More as a barometer of how bad something was without being expected to actually be carried out. And there's all types of ways that Jewish law limits how often we actually implemented it. But in theory, it is on the books.
Stoning, burning...
Beheading and strangulation.
Sounds like somebody else.
Excuse me, what name, in Hebrew, what was the name for Lord that they used? Do you know? In the Torah. When he says don't pronounce the name Lord, do you know which name of Lord was used?
This is, I think, this should be the Tetragrammaton, if I remember correctly. This should be the Tetragrammaton. Right, you like Yud Kei Vav Kei, like what? Oh, sorry, the four letter name of God.
Okay.
Right,
yeah, yeah, okay.
Right, Tetra,
yeah,
Tetra,
yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Got it.
Right.
What is the source, if any, for not pronouncing the name Yud Hei Vav Hei, which can be pronounced? Technically, it can be, but is that just a representation of the name?
You mean pronouncing it as it's written?
Yes. But or is that just a representation of an unknown pronunciation that was once known at a later date than this by the high priest, and he only said it once a year? Right? Is that correct?
Right, I mean, according to the rabbis, right, that the pronunciation of the name was limited to the temple, uh-huh. Right? There's at least one record from one of the German. Medieval scholars that the custom in his shul in Germany in like the 12th century was to use it on Yom Kippur anyways during Berachot Kohanim. How he knew the pronunciation, I don't know. How exactly pronounce it is a bit complicated, right? It's probably not the way that the J witnesses pronounce it. That's probably not correct. What is the correct, I don't know. But yes, meaning the sages' statement for it is lo kishani nikra, nichtavani nikra. As I am written, I am not called, right? We refer to God as master, right, with Adonai, right, with the Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud, right? And we don't pronounce this name, which is, so to speak, the proper name of God, if we can use proper name as a description.
But is the
right.
Source, when Moses asked, tell me your name, and is that the only source? And they said, I'm not telling
I mean, the source name. Is really, yeah, I mean, that the name is you know, this secret, you know, esoteric thing, and what it represents about God is, you know, has some mystical, you know, connotations to it that are best left to, you know, the temple and to unique situations. Okay, so then this story continues. Now, this is a harsh story, and it's now it's going to move from harsh to weird, and then come back to harsh. Okay, so let's just try to. You know what? In order to emphasize how weird this story is going to be, okay, for a second, pretend that lines 14 to 19 don't exist. Okay, 14 to 19 don't exist. So let's read again. Line from line 12. Just let's see. I'm going to read from line 12 12, 13, 20, and 21, and tell me if anything is missing in the story. Okay? So, 12. The whole community shall stone him, stranger or citizen. If he has thus pronounced the name, he shall be put to death. Moses spoke thus to the Israelites, and they took the blasphemer outside the camp and pelted him with stones. The Israelites did as the Lord had commanded Moses. Is there anything missing if I read the story like that?
They don't tell us to put him to death.
What?
They hit him with stones. It doesn't say he died.
Oh, fine. But, well, I mean, the assumption is he's stoned to death. But if I just read the story that way, is there anything missing?
No.
No, it's a perfect story. I mean, it's a harsh story. It is a story, though. It is a coherent storyline, right? Blasphemer, don't know what to do with him, imprison him, ask God, give sentence, carry out sentence, end of story. Very simple, straightforward. This is like how I wrote a story when I was in... Yeah, exactly, right? Beginning, middle, end. Tell them what you're going to do. Do it. Tell them what you've done, right? Perfect story. Yes, if my third grade self had written this story, the teacher might have wondered, right, about my psychological well-being. But fine, right? But at least structurally, the story makes a lot of sense, right? Yeah.
There's such a jarring juxtaposition of the mother's, the connotation of the mother's name with the stoning.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, there is. Shlomit bat divri, right? The one of peace. Right, Shlomit, yes. Oh. There is something very striking about her name, which is one of peace. Right, Shlomit bat divrei. And there is a midrash which I didn't include, which actually picks up on this, on her name. And this actually being, which the implication is that it's meant to be a metaphor for the Jewish people and their relationship with God. And that's the midrash picks up on the weirdness here, right? That you have this... clearly very confrontational individual who is both confrontational with human beings and God, and his mother is Shlomit, right, is the woman of peace. Okay, but let's see what actually happens in the middle, okay? 14 to 19, right? Just to emphasize the weirdness here, I'm going to go back to 12 again. So this is how the story actually reads. The whole community shall stone him, stranger or citizen. If he has thus pronounced the name, he shall be put to death. If anyone kills any human being, he shall be put to death. One who kills a beast shall make restitution for it, life for life. If anyone maims his fellow, as he has done, so shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. The injury he inflicted on another shall be inflicted on him. One who kills a beast shall make restitution for it. But one who kills a human being shall be put to death. You shall have one standard for stranger and citizen alike, for I, the Lord, am your God. Does anything here strike anybody else as very odd?
No mention of blaspheming.
Well, he just said the blaspheming, right? That was in 9 through 13.
14.
He's giving
just
permission.
He's giving people, he's giving telling permission them to do this.
And what?
He's telling them to what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to stone and kill or whatever. And then the end result is anyone who stones or kills...
Right, so one of the interesting things here is, right, is the... And this is in general jarring in the Torah, but it's the Torah goes out of its way to emphasize this, which is... we hold human life in highest regard and still have the death penalty, right? That...
if you take the name of the Lord...
And well, I mean, and other things, like murder, as will be here, right?
What he did, then just say something.
Right, I mean, we'll get to what that is, but... Right, so one of the things, yes, I mean, I don't know if it's weird as much as it highlights the irony that is implicit in the Torah, that the Torah, despite the fact that it values human life so much, says there is such a thing as a death penalty, right? Meaning there are consequences that are worth taking away human life. But even without that, what strikes me here is just, yeah?
That, the whole, who's going to put the whole community to death
exactly,
for taking a life?
Oh, I have even something, I have something even more basic than that, right? Which is, why is this here, right? I mean, imagine the scene, right? Just, right, as we said, you don't need this in the story, right? You have, story again. Guy gets into a fight, blasphemes, is put in a holding cell. They ask God, what do we do? He says, you put him to death. Now the next thing you expect is line 20, and they carry out the sentence and end of story. Right? And then we can talk from today to tomorrow is why is it that blasphemy gets the death penalty? Why is the death penalty exist at all in Judaism? We can talk about that forever. But if we just take the text on its own terms, it's very strange that if I was God and I was coming to give instructions, I would not use the opportunity to just list a bunch of laws, right? Oh, you asked me a question about blasphemy. Parenthetically, as long as I have you here, you should know that murder carries the death penalty, and if you damage property, then you pay for it, and if you damage a human being, then you have to make restitution. And that, I mean, why is God, in the middle of this discussion, going on this aside? Like, you just imagine the scene, right? You have the whole Jewish people, right? This was a catastrophe. You have this person, it was a public fight, they put him in the holding cell, everyone's waiting. What is God going to say? And Moses goes in to get the report from God. And then Moses comes out and the people turn to him and they say, what did he say? What did he say? And he said, well, he said we put him to death. And they said, okay. And he said, wait. He said a bunch of other things. He said that if you kill, then you also be put to death. And by the way, you know, last week when you accidentally knocked over his horse and he broke his leg, God said you owe him for that also. And you know, when you got into a fight and you punched the person you were angry at, you'll have to pay for that too. And, I was talking to him, so he said a bunch of laws. Okay, done with the lesson. Let's go out and carry out the sentence of the blasphemer. Let's go back out and actually execute the criminal. Right? The whole scenario jumps out at you as extremely strange. Like, what is God doing? Like, why are we taking a break in the middle of this story? Yeah.
God is saying they should go out and kill him. And it's a lot of people that are going out to kill him, not one person who's given the responsibility, which would suggest to me, why wouldn't everybody be guilty of killing another person?
Exactly.
That's what bothers me. The other thing that I, and again, it may be in the reading of it, and I haven't got the Hebrew text, so I can't speak to it, but the whole community shall stone him, stranger or citizen, if he in fact pronounced the name, which would suggest there should be some kind of a trial to determine whether he did or he didn't.
And right. In this case,
defend himself. So I find that, again, maybe the if doesn't mean that, but to me it would suggest that there is maybe a question, and that person should have the right to speak for himself.
So I mean, normally it is definitely true that you get a trial and you get proof. The if doesn't carry the. I'm saying the im, I don't think, carries the, if he did it, implying he didn't, right? Meaning, here, the implication is he did, and they know he committed the crime. Now they're asking God what to do with him, and God is saying, this is what you do, and in the future, no, this is always what you do.
We have a God of mercy and a God of justice, supposedly. Wouldn't he have at least the opportunity to suggest why he did it? Was there any justification for why he did it? And this text is saying there is no justification. Period. The end.
And that, I think, is going to be the key to this whole story, which is, you're right. The question hanging in the air is, why did he do it? And was there a justification? And you're right. I think God is going to have to explain not just the sentence, but God is going to have to explain why there's no justification. And I think, right, in classic Jewish fashion, we will answer a question with another question, right? The question I raised, which is, why does God interrupt this story with a side point about law, is going to be answered by the question, what drove him and why wasn't he justified? Those, I think, are going to end up answering each other, and that's what I'm going to try to explore today. Yeah?
Yeah, I was just wondering if the definition of death life is not really just a physical thing here. It's about a spiritual death that this individual is going to incur. This is maybe we're not talking about taking the eye for the eye, the tooth for the tooth. We're talking about a spiritual death.
As his consequence. I mean, here he clearly is also physically being killed. Whether he also has consequences of the world to come, I assume there are. What they are, I don't know.
But you were saying it doesn't happen very often.
Here is one of the cases where it clearly does. The Torah records that it did happen, but normally it doesn't, right? Normally, the reason that we discuss the Torah has death penalties is more to tell us the severity of crimes. The only exception that the Talmud records where the sages would go out of their way to ensure that something was actually, that justice was carried out, was in murder. Because murder, you have the double problem. You have not just the punishment aspect of it, but you have the protection of society aspect. So if you, right, if you are overly, you know, lenient on murderers, then you have murderers run amok. So that, right, was a problem that they didn't want to, you know, deal with. Yeah.
But this blasphemer, first of all, pronounced a name that nobody knows how to pronounce.
Well, apparently he did. Apparently he did. We don't.
He was the special one that was a, that's a contradiction. And then,
well, no, meaning I assume that when God introduced himself, he introduced him with his name. They were there for the Ten Commandments, right? When God said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, right, presumably he introduced himself with his proper name. God, presumably God knows pronounce. I don't know it. But
that's his name. He was denied. He said, I'm not telling you my name.
Well, but except the, well, I mean, he was, he, I'm not telling you my full presence, but his name, he introduced himself in Anochi Hashem Elokecha, right? Yeah.
Or a name represents.
Yeah.
Is it possible that all these laws are here because that gives people, now there's a heads up. If you do these things, it's going to happen to you because nobody knew not to do it then.
Can't hear you.
Oh, it's a lesson.
Yeah, so I think part of it is going to be that this is put here as a, as a, as a warning, right? That in the future you should know. But as we'll see, right, I think it's a very particular type of warning. I don't think it's just a generic warning because, right, even if it is a warning, the question is, why does it come here, right? But I think there's a reason it comes here, and it's warning to something very specific. And I think not just to not committing the crime, but this is going to come back to your question, the issue of motivation for crimes, and is there any justification for crimes, or is the law absolute? And that's what we will, we'll come to, but I think that's going to be part of it. Now, I'm going to keep you in suspense as to for this for a moment. And first, let's try to justify. Let's try to, for a moment, leave aside the fact that he's going to get killed and that God clearly didn't think there was any justification for what happened. Let's get into the mind of the blasphemer, right? Because this is... So the last 2 weeks, we've dealt with people who argued with God nicely, right? Maybe with a little bit of chutzpah, but we're on God's team. Now we're talking about someone who curses God, right? This is someone, so if, you know, these 6 weeks we're exploring arguing with God, we've done 2 weeks of when God was clearly okay with people arguing, and here, where God says no, right, we're drawing a line, this type of arguing, reaction, anger is bad, right? But before we see why God drew his line, let's figure out why did the blasphemer, what was he annoyed about, right? Avram was annoyed by God's justice, was worried about God's justice in this world, so he argues. Moses wanted to defend the Jewish people, so he argues. The blasphemer curses God for some reason, right? There's something God did, seemingly, right? Or human beings did, that he's invoking God, but he's angry at God for something and responds. And yet God said this isn't okay. So why is he angry?
He's angry because the half-Israelite status that he had caused an argument between him and someone who considers himself better.
Right, so first clue we have is that he's angry because he got into a fight because he is a half, right, he is half whatever, he's half part of the nation, right? He is, right, that's the first clue, right? He's clearly an outsider, or a half outsider, right? And that is a problem. Now, yeah?
There is another problem, at which, because the law wasn't made at that point, he didn't know that what he did would have been subject to being put to death, which even makes it worse in my mind for his not having the opportunity to defend himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think under normal circumstances, right, you can't be prosecuted with a crime that has not yet been put down.
God is trying to make this
a point.
The point of why we do it. I mean,
yes, I think you're right. I think part of what's going to have to be here is an educational lesson, because you're right. Normally, this wouldn't be fair for the very simple reason that he didn't yet know this was a capital crime. I assume he knew it was forbidden, right? It's no worse than using God's name in vain, but he didn't know it was capital, right? Normally, but you're right. And if it weren't for the fact that God says, despite that, put him to death, we wouldn't do it. And it's clear that a point is being made, right? And we have to figure out what the point is going to be. But first, let's try to empathize.
Okay.
And the light goes off.
God spoke.
Yes, and God spoke, yeah. But let's try to empathize with him. So point clue one is that the blasphemer is clearly angry with society. He is an outsider. Right? That's clear. What other clue do we have of why he might be angry? Specifically, what type of half-Jew, for lack of a better term, is he?
Egyptian.
Egyptian. Now means which now if we had to assume most likely, right? Then how did that happen? Right? What is the most likely way that he became a child of a Jewish woman and an Egyptian man?
Rape.
Right? Rape is clearly the most likely, right? The most likely reason that this happened. And that assumption that the most likely way this person came into existence was through rape, combined with a series of textual clues that we'll see in 1 second, the sages put together in the Midrash an interesting backstory to what happened. So they note an interesting textual parallel between this story and a different story in Exodus 2, if you look at number 2. And it was during those many days that Moses grew up and went out. So here with the English, it's not so, because I used different translations. But, and went out, if you look back at line 3, right? There came out, right? That's actually the same word in Hebrew, right? Vayetzeh, right? So, to his brethren, and he saw their suffering, and he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man, one of his brethren. He turned this way and that, and saw that there was no one. And he struck the Egyptian and buried him in the sand. Right. So this is the right. This is the famous. Right. This is the. Origin story. There we go. Origin story of Moses. Right. This is the. Right. This is how Moses became Moses. This was his first. Right. It's the. You have them in all, you know, superhero, right? You know, books and movies, right? How Peter Parker became Spider-Man, how Clark Kent discovered he was Superman, right? So this is how Moses discovers he is super Jew. Yeah, great. Okay, fine. So right, he's empathetic, right? That's what he is, right? He stands up for the Jews. So, and he went out on the second day, and behold, two Hebrew men were quarreling, right? Now, here is our third parallel, right, to our story. You have Moses going out, right, that Vayetzeh. You have the Egyptian, and you have Jews fighting, right? We have three tropes, right, from this story. And he said to the guilty party, "Why are you striking your neighbor?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptians?" So Moshe feared and said, "Indeed, the matter is known." So you have parallel number 4, which is the person in the fight is afraid, right, that he's going to be killed by Moses, right, by the representative of, who will eventually be the representative of God. So the sages picked up on two things. One is the literary parallels and thematic parallels between Moses' origin story and the story of the blasphemer. And two is the question hanging in the air is the most likely way that this blasphemer came into existence was through rape, right? What, if we tried to use our imagination a bit, right? When would that rape have happened? So the sages in what one of my teachers likes calling the conservation of biblical personalities, right? One of the midrashic tools is the conservation of biblical personalities, which is if we don't know of new characters, so we try to combine characters. So we have a nameless Jew here. We have a nameless Jew at the story of the blasphemer, right? We have some hanging questions that aren't answered. So the best way, and we have literary parallels that start indicating that maybe these two stories are connected, so we conserve biblical personalities, and we create a story, right? We intuit a story that brings them together. And this is the story they tell. So if you look at 3, let's skip to 48. Right, to line 48 to 53, where we'll see the stories. Rashi cites the Midrash. The son of an Egyptian man, It was the Egyptian who Moses had killed. Among the children of Israel, this teaches us that he had become a proselyte. He'd fully converted. Right? Again, the assumption here, coming back to the question, I forget who asked it before, of when we moved to matrilineal descent. This midrash assumes that this person actually was a convert, because in Egypt we were still going by patrilineal, and therefore he has to convert. Right? By current standards he would be Jewish, but by, right, or he's some sort of convert, okay? They quarreled in or concerning the camp, about manners connected with the camp. And, well, you know, let's just stop there for a second. So I didn't put the whole midrash, but let me tell you the rest of the story. Right? The midrash, in its full, says that what happened was, this was the son of that man, right, of the Egyptian who had been killed. And then they tell the rest of the story.
Oh.
The woman who had been raped was the wife of the person he was beating. Because, right, the first thing a slave overlord is going to do if he rapes a woman is destroy the evidence, right? So they imagine what happened, that the father of this person they put at Datan, right? Right, they assume he's one of the rebels in the Jewish camp. But at any rate, right, he goes back and he sees his wife being raped by an Egyptian, right, taskmaster. So he tries to stop him. So the Egyptian taskmaster decides, well, the best way to deal with the situation is to kill him, right? And Moses steps in and kills the Egyptian and saves the father.
The father.
He saves the father from the Egyptian. So the sages put the story together. The husband of the woman, the father of the blasphemer. Right? Right? I mean, the blasphemer is the son of the man. Right? So Shlomit bat Divri is the woman who was raped.
Yes.
By her husband was the person the Egyptian was trying to kill, and their son is the blasphemer. That's how the Midrash puts the two stories together.
The Egyptian.
Correct. Yeah. Right? Meaning, right? I mean, she would have.
The Egyptian called Sam.
Right. The Egyptian called Sam rapes Shulamit bat Divri, has the blasphemer who's now raised by Shulamit bat Divri and his mother's husband. Right? Who's a Jew? Her husband is Jewish. His biological father is the Egyptian who was trying to kill his mother's husband. Right? So that's the story. What? So they do, right? So this is what I said. The Midrash doesn't know for sure, right? The Midrash, right? The Midrash, right? What? No, for sure. As I said, right? Right? Classic Midrashic methodology here, right, is, as I said, conservation of biblical personalities. We have two stories that share literary and thematic parallels, and we have a question hanging in the air, which is, why was the Egyptian beating this particular man, and who raped Shlomit bat Divri such that they had the blasphemer? So the Midrash, in its own methodology, right, conserves it and answers all the questions by saying, here's the scenario, right? Shlomit bat Divri is raped, the Egyptian tries to kill her husband, Moses kills the Egyptian,
Does her husband stay alive?
What? He survives. He survives, right? Hence, he's the one.
We're missing a practical piece here. So the Israelite husband raised him.
So the Israelite husband raises.
Somehow, how does the whole world
presumably
know that maybe the rapist is the father? Like, where does that come from?
Or maybe didn't raise him. Maybe he's dead. I don't know. Maybe, right? I'm just assuming that he's raised by his.
That's a big piece of information.
Well, clearly, right? However it happened, clearly people do know, and that's an uncomfortable situation for the guy to be in because.
Exactly. Maybe he just found out that someone told him about this rape. Maybe
so I don't know if he just found out now, or he is known and he's always been an outcast, or now he's becoming an outcast. But clearly, however it happened, at this point, he's either dealing with years of pent up, you know, frustration, or he's dealing with the anger of finding out, or whatever the case may be. Right? The Midrash is now again Midrash. Just to make a point, Midrash sometimes is trying to make a historical point. And sometimes it isn't trying to make an historical point, it's trying to make a thematic point. Right? Now, whether the Midrash actually thinks this is what happened, or it's making the point that it's highlighting the fact that even if it wasn't this person, Shlomit Bat Divri, if she had a child who was the son of an Egyptian, was probably in a scenario, if it wasn't this one, was exactly like that one, right? Which is extremely likely, right? Meaning, even if the Midrash is not telling you historical truth, right? That this was the same story, they're telling you what's clearly historical truth, that the most likely what happened is that this child is the product of rape,
right?
And that now he's dealing with the problem of whenever he found out that he is the child of rape and therefore has no father among the Jewish people and therefore doesn't deserve to inherit, even if he's Jewish, right? He is dealing with that anger, right? He's dealing with that anger. Now, the sages then take it one step further and they ask the obvious question, right? Which is, what is the most likely reason that he is angry? Right? I'll put it better. What is the most likely reason that a half Jew, right, is getting into a fight? If it's not just, right, it could just be he's angry. But if you wanted to guess what he's going to create the most animosity towards his fellow Jews at any point in his life, what is it going to be?
Money.
Money. Specifically?
Land.
Inheritance of land. Well, right, but that, yeah.
I think that's an anti-Semitic answer. I lived this situation when I was at camp. There's a man I knew who, as a boy, was a reprehensible teenager at camp. He was a CIT with me. He grew up to be an even more reprehensible guy.
Yeah.
And I went through the same thing with him, with this, except it was different. It didn't have this Midrash thing. There was a boy in our group, a CIT also, whose father wasn't Jewish. This other fellow, you knew exactly what I had to not say.
Exactly.
Was constantly calling him a goy.
Oh.
I was in a fist fight with him one night. Neither one of us was rehired for Northland because the camp director saw us this, but we were just about to get it. Anyway, I think that was a horrible, terrible, awful thing for you. And maybe that's what was going on here.
So,
you are only an Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he said, well, you're a so-and-so, whatever it is, which referred to our God. Our God said, look, this is not good. There are a lot of things I can put up with, but I'm not just the God. I am the reason for your very existence. If you say this about me, everything is nullified. You are not who you're supposed to be because I am. As Popeye would say, I am what I am. And that's what God said. I am what I am, and you can't do this. Now, we're going to have to kill you. Now, we can't kill you. So this is what we're going to do. And I guess this is what they did.
Stop.
All put your hands on his head, and we all throw the rocks. We don't know who killed
again,
him. We don't know who the actual assassin or executioner was, because all the rocks flew. And
right.
That's the way we get off of this. As when people shoot, execute people with guns, sometimes only one of the rifles has a bullet in it.
Correct.
We don't know whom to blame. So this was bad. We're not going to do it again. And that's my answer to all this other
So I think, and we'll see, I think a lot of what you said is exactly going to be what's going on in this story. Now I say, the reason, by the way, why I say that it's money, I don't mean money, right, because he's greedy. I mean that as bad as it is to call somebody a guy, right, just say you're a non-Jew, you're not really part of us, right, where that comes to a fore is not money, it's where they say, right, you're not going to inherit land with us, means you'll have nowhere to live among us, right? That's much more painful than money. That is years of people saying, you're not really Jewish, you're not really Jewish. And then, right, you're going to go into the land of Israel. And they say, not only that, but you're going to have nowhere to live. Right? Because we're dividing up the land amongst people whose fathers are Jewish. And you will be excluded. Right? The reason come to a fore is not because of greed. It's because, right, I've tried to fit in. Right? I don't fit in. Right? And that's basically what the Midrash says. If you look at Rashi at the beginning, he said, whence did he go out from? So they say, where was he coming from? And they tell a story. Now again, as I said, the Midrash, whether it's trying to tell you historical fact or pick up on the implicit, right, emotions that are running high in this story is an open question in Midrash. Sometimes in Midrashim are trying to fill in actual historical details. Sometimes they're trying to highlight the emotions that are permeating the story.
And I think there's one other thing Midrash does, which is troublesome. It tries to justify things that we can't explain by the text. And the justification...
Well, it hasn't actually justified him yet.
Well, so
right? It's actually making...
cases that
sometimes it does, but sometimes here it actually provides him with... Here it actually is empathizing with him, right? Which is only going to make it worse when we end up killing him. Right? So let's see what the Midrash... So he does. So he says, whence did he go out from? Right? So surely not from the camp. The scripture states, and they strove in the camp. Right? He hadn't left the camp. He's in the camp. So Rabbi Levi said, he went out from, by his blasphemous utterance, he lost his eternal life. So one midrashic read is, through this he loses the world to come. Okay, fine. Rabbi Brachia said, he set forth, meaning started his argument from the above section. What? Sorry, number three. Number three at the beginning. Line 34. 34 now. He said sneeringly. Right, so... The story before this had been the discussion of the lechem apanim, the bread, the show bread. So the midrashically they connect the story before. So Brachit said he set forth from the above section. He said sneeringly, every Sabbath he shall set it in order. Surely this is the way of the king to eat fresh, meaning warm bread every day. Is it perhaps his way to eat bread 9 days old? Fine, meaning the bread was left from week to week, and then it was brought out. Right on the last Friday from the temple, that's when it was brought. Okay, fine. So that's another possibility. But the main one I want to focus on is in line 37. And this is what we'll bring it together. A Braita states, he went out means he came out of the judicial court of Moses, where he had been pronounced to be in the wrong in the following matter. Although his father was an Egyptian, he had gone to pitch his tent in the camp of the tribe of Dan. Right now, what is the Midrash picking up on? That the Torah went out of the way to tell you his mother was Shlomit Badivri Limmate Dan.
Jewish.
Well, not just Jewish, but it tells you tribe. Why tribe? Why is tribe necessary? Because that's what he was worried about. That he went to Dan, because that was where his mother was from, and he pitched his tent. And they, the men of Dan, said to him, what have you to do here? Meaning, what is your character that gives you the right to come here? He replied, I am one of the children of the tribe of Dan. Thereupon they said to him, scripture states, every man of the children of Israel shall encamp by his own standard, by his own flag, that bears the signs of their father's house. He thereupon went into the judicial court to have the matter decided, and came forth, meaning Yatzah declared to be in the wrong, and then stood up and blasphemed. Right? Meaning, the Midrash is picking up, and as I said, the Midrash here is picking up, is being empathetic, is picking up on what probably happened. You have a guy, his father was an Egyptian who had raped his mother. Right. And all his life, all he wants to do is fit in.
Right?
Right? So he goes to Mate Dan, where his mother is from, Shlomit Bat Divri, Mate Dan, and he pitches his camp. And they say, you have no place here, right? Years of in camp, them saying, you're not Jewish, you're not Jewish, you're not Jewish. And all he wanted to do was fit in.
Wow.
And he pitches his camp, and they say, get out of here. The only people who get land who can pitch their tent is people whose fathers are Jewish. You have no place to go. Right?
Yes.
And he says, right?
But it also makes the assumption that everybody in the camp knew their son, whereas maybe she didn't live in the camp when she was living.
Perhaps, but it's clear by this point in the story, right? The story clearly says that they know, right? The implication of the story is they know that he is the son of an Egyptian man, and that is clearly part of what's driving him. So the Midrash is empathizing, is trying to imagine what would have happened, right? What would have led him to this point to curse God? And the answer, when you think about it, is pretty reasonable. That they rejected him, the utter rejection, and he has no place to go. Right? So he turns to God. Right?
Yeah.
Now blaspheming could be one of two things. Right? And right, as the Midrash, we look at line 52. Who was he fighting with? The most likely thing, this was his opponent who had prevented him from pitching his tent in the camp of, that should not be Daniel, of Dan. Right? Meaning the person who tried stopping him. Right? Right. This makes a lot of sense, right?
Absolutely.
You, right? The Midrash is telling a reasonable story. Who is he most likely to fight with? The person responsible for throwing him out.
Right.
Right? Because he's a half-Jew, and he wants to find his place, and he has no place, so he just curses. Now.
Wouldn't God have been merciful to him?
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Yeah.
Those Turkish letters.
Exactly. When
there was a reason for it, just didn't
And here we have all the questions building up, and here is where we're going to have to come to an answer. But let me do one more question, and then we'll bring all the questions together. We have to. All these questions will eventually come to an answer, which hopefully will shed insight, but we'll see. So then he turns. Now, as we said, when he says he blasphemes, it could mean one of two things. It could mean he curses the human being in the name of God, but it most likely means he cursed God. Why would the person... I understand why he would curse the other person, right? But why would he curse God?
Right, if you because he's alone. There's nobody.
He allowed his mother to be raped. I mean, it's a
right?
horrible thing.
Because he allowed his mother to be raped. And because
he wants to be Jewish.
But and he wants to be Jewish, and it's God's laws that are denying him the right to inherit.
And God
right?
is supposed to be merciful.
And God's supposed to be merciful. We understand why he's cursing God. Why is he cursing God? Because, yeah, who said, you created me, what did you, right? Who? Someone said it before, right? He's going to turn to God and say, you created me, why did you let my mother conceive? When exactly. right? When she was raped. Like, you wanted me to be born in a world where I'm going to be a half Jew. I'm going to not have any place to inherit. No one's ever going to ever accept me. Right? I don't. Right? What am I doing here? And where do we have this notion in Job. Where, right? Where Job's, after Job is suffering and suffering and suffering and suffering. At some point his wife just said to him, why don't you curse God? And he says, right, I won't curse God. But eventually he starts cursing and he starts getting angry. But what does he curse? The day I was born. Right? Because what is she really telling him? Curse God, because cursing God is a way of saying, I wish I was never born. Meaning you created me. You put me in this situation. Why did you do that? Right? I have no recourse. I thought Moses would be my recourse. The legal system would at least protect my rights. But no, your law doesn't protect me. Right? Why did you create me? And in frustration and anger, he curses God. And at this point, we are all sympathizing and empathizing with this poor guy who has had a miserable life, right? And now God needs to come and explain why, despite the fact that he's had a hard life, despite the fact that we totally understand what drove him to anger, why? It doesn't matter. The consequences of his actions will be the same as if there was no backstory. And here we come back to our original question, which is, what is going on in lines 14 to 19? Why did God take a break in the middle of his sentencing of the blasphemer and tell us a series of laws? Right, so let's look back at that laws.
The law.
What?
Because the law is the law.
Well, the law is the law, but there's going to be one line, and I want you to keep your eye out for the line. I'm going to read it one more time, and when the line jumps out at you, right? Right? Let me know. So, if anyone kills any human being, he shall be put to death. Now, parenthetically, why is murder usually happen? In a vacuum or because of a backstory?
Backstory.
Backstory. One who kills a beast shall make restitution for it, life for life. If one maims his fellow, as he has done, so shall it be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. When people get into fights, why do they usually get into fights?
Because he did it to him.
Because they think they're justified. There's some backstory, right? Everything in life has a backstory. The injury inflicted on another shall be inflicted on him. One who kills a beast shall make restitution for it. But one who kills a human being shall be put to death. You shall have one standard for stranger and citizen, for I, the Lord, am your God.
Well, Moses
killed that father.
Yeah.
And
that
also, if you can't kill,
well, killed the Egyptian who was killing somebody else.
Why is it okay to kill a beast for sacrifice?
Different.
No, you're not, because the reason you can't kill a beast is if it belongs to somebody else, because it's damage against the owner, not against the animal.
A beast is a beast.
Right, but the context is clearly about restitution to the owner. You're not restoring it to the animal. Meaning the sacrifice is, right, there's nothing wrong in the Torah's view of killing the animal. It's destroying someone else's property, in this case an animal. But the key to the entire story seems to be that last line. That God comes down and says, look, I get it. I get it. You're angry. You're upset. But you know what? Every murderer is upset about something. Right? Every person who gets into a fight is angry about something. But law has to be law. Because otherwise, if I let you off, right, then the next person is going to commit murder, and what's he going to say?
But he didn't.
I was justified.
He didn't murder anybody.
Well, that's a different law. That's the law that if someone's in the middle of murdering, you can stop him by killing him. Right? I mean, the father, the Egyptian father is beating somebody to death. So that the law is, right, that... Right, meaning you are allowed to defend a victim from his potential murderer, right? So Moses is defending, right, the person who's about to be killed. Now that's true in pretty much any legal system in the world, right? Short of, like, some Christian scientists who think you can't do that, right? Basically, every legal and religious system in the world thinks that you're allowed to, that if faced with a choice of the life of a potential murderer and the life of a victim, the victim comes first, even at the cost of the murderer. By entering into murder, you give up your right to your life. But under normal circumstances, right, everyone has a backstory. No one even remembers, right? If you think, for example, you think about Romeo and Juliet, right? It opens up. We have no idea why the Montesquieus and the Capulets have been fighting for so long. We just know they hate each other and each side thinks they're right. Why are they fighting? I have no idea. They've been fighting for who knows how many generations. The families hate each other. And if you ask the Montesquieus, why do you fight and are you ready to kill and damage and whatever I don't remember which one I said. The Capulets, the Montesquieus, Montesquieus and the Capulets, whatever it is, right? The Montesquieus will say, what do you mean? The Capulets have been our sworn enemies. They hate us. Why? I don't know, right? They've been fighting for generations. It must be for some reason. Right? It must be justified, right? But right? Why do you hate them? Why do you kill them? Why do you fight them? Right? The answer will always be something, right? Now, sometimes that something is something we empathize with, right? Sometimes it isn't. But the point is that law is law, because the second you say that. Well, you have a backstory. You have a, right? You've had a hard life, right? Then, I mean, what does that really say, right? If you think about it, right? As much as we want to bring in extenuating circumstances, let me just finish the sentence, we'll take a question in a second. Extenuating circumstances are nice, right? They are important to understand context. But when you say you shouldn't punish the person at all, because he's had a hard life. What are you really saying?
They're different standards for different people.
Right? And you're saying even more. Why are there different standards? Because? What are you really saying? He was abused as a child. Therefore. Right? What are you saying by allowing him... You're more than justifying. What are you really... Right? You're justifying, but you're really attacking a core principle of, right, of humanity, which is... Right? And why isn't he accountable? What are you really, really saying?
The laws don't count.
Yeah, even more. What are you really saying about him? He has no free will. He has no choice. Right? If you let somebody get away, if you give excuses to murder, right, what you're really saying is that people can't break free of their history. But that can't be true in law. Because if we let every person who was abused as a child abuse, right, it's one thing to say we understand, we empathize. It's another thing to say the law can't hold you accountable. Because at the end of the day, for every person who was abused as a child, who abused us as an adult, there's a person who was abused as a child who makes sure to be a better father than his father who abused him. And you can empathize and you can do whatever you want, but if law allows people to get away because their life was hard, right? What former President Bush said, right? It's the soft bigotry of low expectations, right? It's that if someone has had a troubled life and for the rest of his life, therefore, you give him a pass on everything you do, that breeds misconduct, right? That breeds crime. Because if the law builds in and says, anybody who's had a hard life, we won't hold accountable, then anyone who's had a hard life won't hold themselves accountable. Now, you can empathize and you can sympathize, but what the law is telling you is, look, every murder has a backstory. Every attack has a backstory. But you still have free choice. You still have to make a decision, and therefore God says that. Now, we can talk maybe after class about why it is that blasphemy per se, right, carries with it the death penalty, right? Which, right, clearly in a theological world, right, we live in the 21st century, and it's hard for us to grapple with the fact that a theological crime carries the death penalty. But if I rewrote the story as follows, right, two guys were fighting, and, right, we'll go back to the camp story, right? Two guys were fighting, and the person called him a guy and said, "You have no place in this camp." So he takes a bat to his skull and he kills the other counselor. Right? I said, if I rewrote the story, right, everyone would understand that you can understand why he's angry, but we wouldn't let him get a pass. What punishment we would give him, leave aside the question of the death penalty or not. Right? Let's isolate it. Right? Right? If he came with a bat and broke the guy's skull, we would all say, "I don't care how much he insulted you, right? I understand it was painful, right? But you don't just kill somebody. You don't get a pass just because he insulted you." Now, the fact that the Torah views blasphemy at that level is an assumption that the story works with. Right? And I know, for 21st century people, it's hard to swallow that blasphemy is that type of crime. Okay, we have questions, and then we'll finish up. Yeah?
I just have a couple of comments here. But one comment is, it's not what happens to us in life, it's how we respond. And what I've been studying in Judaism is God brings these situations to us for us to develop in certain ways and so forth, which is a positive, like the child who's abused and becomes the better father. There's another way of looking at this too, how the punishment, you know, where two people are fighting physically and one person does kill the other person. So this involves intention. What is the intention behind the action here? And that's why we have these different laws for, you know, someone kills somebody in a fight, it's unintentional, so that's self-defense or things like that. And it's not, and the punishment isn't necessarily death. And we also value life in Judaism. So if somebody does something, we have to focus on the value of life. And we're not so quick to give them death. Because
right.
We have the whole concept of tshuva. And we're not so quick.
Right, but in Judaism, as is true, it's in Judaism, unlike in American law, right, or Canadian law, or secular law, or whatever, right, repentance has no place in the courtroom, right? In the court, someone can't come into the court and say, you know, I sinned, don't punish me. The answer is no. Repentance is for God, no. In Jewish law,
in civil law.
What?
In civil law, it does happen.
Right.
It does happen in criminal law, of course.
Not in Jewish law. No, I'm saying that's exactly my point, is that in Western law it happens. In Jewish law it doesn't. In Jewish law, I regret what I did is no excuse. Once you committed the crime, right, God can forgive you in heaven, but on earth, human beings have to hold you accountable. There is no such thing as tshuva in court. So that's what I said at the beginning, is that in general, the rabbis understood that actual carrying out the death penalty was very rare, because putting the death penalty was more of a way of God indicating this is a really bad crime. Sometimes you did carry it out. Now here, right, God said carry it out. And I would say, as harsh as it is, right, and I'm happy to stay around after for a bit, right, the main point that comes out of this story, right, is that God sets forth and says, you can argue, you can be angry, you can do whatever you want. But in the end of the day, where you draw the line is, you can't let your anger, right, get to the point where you think you have no free will, where you're going to get a pass on your actions, right? So week one and two, we saw where people were allowed to argue with God. Here he's arguing with God, and God says, no, you don't, you want to argue with me? You want to be angry? Fine, be angry. But you want to go and commit a crime in your anger? You're not going to get a pass, because that's where I draw the line. And just to prove this point, if you look at the end, the Midrash is a beautiful way of saying this. Right? Remember, this person is he's not actually a mamzer, right? He's someone who is in this unfortunate situation because of the sexual relations of his father and his mother. So this midrash, what?
Not because of the sexual relations.
Right. Meaning, she was raped. Meaning, not because of the immorality, simply because of the situation. Look at 4. This is the midrash on this line. The son of an Israelite woman went out. This is like what it is written in Ecclesiastes. So I returned and considered all the oppressions done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. Daniel the tailor said, behold, the tears of the oppressed refers to mamzerim. I mean, people born from either illicit or even rape relationships of a married woman. Their fathers sinned. But what was the insult to have to do with them? Meaning, it was not their fault. The father of this one went to a woman forbidden to him. But how did this child sin, and how does it concern him? Right? The midrash says, who are the oppressed? They're these children whose fathers were rapists, who raped a married woman. And their status is affected. But it's not their fault.
Right.
They had no comforter. Who is that? But on the side of the oppressors there was power. And now the midrash says something shocking. Who is their oppressor? That refers to the hands of the great Sanhedrin. Right? The midrash is very self-conscious. And you know, it's true. You know who's responsible for oppressing them? The court. The court who's carrying out the will of God. Because it has no choice. But in the end of the day, the result is oppression. That move against him with the authority of the Torah and remove him from the community. Because it is written, a mamzer shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Therefore, says the Holy One, it is upon me to comfort them. In this world they are impure, but in the days of the Messiah, Moriah prophesies, behold, I see them all in pure gold. And Midrash, but what is the Midrash? But what does the Midrash pick up on? Right? The Midrash picks up on the following. That there are situations where not only is your life hard, but where the law that God Himself set down makes your life even harder.
Yeah.
Right? And that only emphasizes what we said before, that you're going to be more upset and you're going to have a reason to curse God because the court is just playing God's role. And God says, look, if you put the two midrashim together, right, it's on the one hand, I empathize. On the one hand, I understand you. And in the world to come, whatever that means, I'll purify you. I understand that's not much of a comfort. I understand you're still oppressed in this world. But that still doesn't give you a pass, right? With all the pain, right? By the Midrash expressing its empathy, by admitting that this situation is unfair, right? It emphasizes this point to a painful degree, which is that the point of this story is that there are reasons to be upset. There are reasons even to be upset with God. Because sometimes life is unfair, and God put us in this situation, and maybe His laws make it even worse. And maybe all of that is true. And yet, people have free will. And we can't allow abusers to abuse their children in turn and give them a pass. Right? And God says that's the key, right, to this story. Is that this person, as angry as he was, and I get it. It's hard. And I made it worse. Right? God is taking ownership for this. The court who told him, you're right, you get no inheritance, it's my fault, because I put that law on the books. It's my fault. But at the end of the day, that doesn't give you a pass. Arguing with God is one thing, right? Committing a crime and using your pain and suffering, no matter how legitimate, as a pass to commit a crime, is something totally different. And that's the sort of painful, but I think true message that the Midrash is trying to paint from this story, is that arguing with God has its limits, because in the end of the day, the one thing we can never forget is that you have free will, and there are consequences to your actions, and even if we sympathize and empathize, and God Himself understands why you're angry, right? Law has to be law, order has to be order, and people have to try to be better than their situations might have dictated.
In our courts, we have, by reason of insanity, a clause for people who commit murder. That you're saying in Jewish law.
So in Jewish law, we do have insanity. We don't have hard upbringing, right? Meaning insanity, because insanity goes to the question of, are you able to have intent? Right? Capacity. So that we have, right? Are you capacity to have intent?
That would be accommodated.
Correct. So that, in Jewish law, we have a status called shote, right? Someone who's mentally incapacitated, right? That clearly does. The one thing that Jewish law, though, emphasizes, which again, I think is on the one hand painful to hear, but on the other hand edifying, right, is that you have free will, and therefore the one time when you can't go to that point where, again, cursing God is really giving up and throwing in the towel and saying, I'm just going to commit every crime and take a pass, right? That's the one thing you can't do, because the Torah wants to emphasize that the last point you have to remember is, no matter how hard life is, and even if we admit it's hard, right, you have the ability, if you try hard enough, to still emerge the ethical person in this story. Okay, we're already over time, so I'll stick around for questions, but we'll end here. And like I said, I know this is a bit hard to swallow. I'm happy to talk about it a little afterwards. And as I said, I'll send out the link to the course. If you want to examine it more, you can check it out there.